The record stuck.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Darcy Steinke joins us via the telephone. Darcy, thanks so much for being on today's program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's grand to talk with you. And I should say we're recording this on the 12th of June, 2024. And today we're going to be talking about your book, Darcy, Flash Count Diary, Menopause, and the Vindication of Natural Life, out with Picador. And before we get started, I'll read your short bio from your website, and then we'll get going. Darcy Steinke is the author of the memoir Easter Everywhere and five novels, Sister Golden Hair, Milk, Jesus Saves, Suicide Blonde, and Up Through the Water. Her books have been translated into 10 languages, and her nonfiction has appeared widely. Her web story, Blind Spot, was a part of the 2000 Whitney Biennial. She has been both a Henry Hoynes and a Stegner Fellow and a writer in residence at the University of Mississippi. She has taught at the New School, Columbia University of the Arts, New York University, Princeton, and the American University of Paris. She lives with her husband in Brooklyn. Darcy, thanks again for talking today. So Darcy, thanks also for choosing today's songs. And so why the Talking Heads that started us off?
I just love that song. I sort of want that song played at my funeral.
Yes.
My worry, sometimes, do I find myself sometimes thinking like, oh, but can we get anybody to play it well? Should we just play the record? You know what I mean? Like, I find myself like actually having those thoughts.
You could have a beautiful
song, and it's also my own. You know, I saw the Stop Making Sense on tour, and it's sort of like my, you know, like I was in my 20s when the Talking Heads started to get big. So it has a lot of, you know, that sort of feeling too. You know how songs are like little, they're like little emotional, like pockets. So there's a lot of emotions in there.
Yes. Oh, completely. And it takes you back to those visual, those memories, the sounds of the time.
Yeah.
And it's good to kind of, as I get older and older, I don't know about you, Darcy, but it's good to have those portals into those other times, you know, and
yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Music is so powerful that way, right?
It is.
Yeah.
I think when I was in college, my friend Kristen said, I don't know if you'd rather be, you know, like the terrible game, would you rather be
blind, right.
Yeah, she'd be like, you'd rather be blind. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. You know what, but that game I really love, because I used to play with my daughter, and we'd be like, we got really surreal. We'd be like, would you rather be a mailbox or a bicycle? and then we would talk about like what it would mean to be a bicycle. But it was actually quite helpful, like, you know, on long car trips and whatnot.
Oh, I love that. That is such a better game. Oh,
yeah. It was good. Yeah.
So Darcy, in Flash Count Diary, you actually, in the last line of the book, you say, you almost, I think, dedicate Flash Count Diary to your daughter and her friends,
right,
her generation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wrote Flash Count Diary partly because, I mean, I myself, this is almost like 10 years ago now, but you know, at the beginning of my menopause, I was maybe 8 years ago, but I was just so disoriented, and I always look for like books that will help me like get through any situation, you know, whether it's nonfiction or novels. And I couldn't really find that many books that were that helpful. And the books that I did find were either sort of like, there were memoirs that sort of made fun of, you know, menopause, like, oh, ha, 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 I'm having a hot flash. I have to run to the window and throw it open, you know, like, or like medical books that were, you know, sort of pushing women on, you know, hormones, which I'm not against. I feel like that's not the only answer. I mean, menopause is a bigger, like, transition than just, you know, just the medical part of it, right? So,
yes.
So I decided I would write my own. So that's how it came about. And I did sort of think about my daughter. Like, I wanted, you know, her and her friends to be able to, I mean, it will be quite a while for them, but actually, I wanted them to go into the transition with a little more, not feeling so lonely and confused, you know?
Yeah, blindsided.
Yeah, blindsided. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because sometimes it's like, I know with my mom, I think she said it's the, you know, the change, you know, and then there wasn't that much more than that.
Right.
Really.
Right. Yeah. You know, there is one good book. Colette wrote a really great book, like a novel about menopause called Break of Day. That's a really great book. That's the best writing about the physical feelings of menopause, I feel like.
And you have that in your book. You mentioned this one.
Yeah. I talk about Colette. Yeah. I tried to read all of the sort of women of a certain age novels, you know, just to, and I was going to have a chapter where I talked about all of them, but it didn't quite fit. So I sort of took out the best, you know, bits and put it into other chapters, you know?
And wove it within things, especially like,
yeah, exactly.
Simone de Beauvoir. She surfaces often.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Isn't she?
I tried to sort of, I don't want this to sound too, you know, fancy, but I tried to, you know, phenomenology was a big mode in which I wrote the book. You know, I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to, you know, phenomenology is about sort of using the body to experience the world. So,
yes. And
that's how she, you know, it's a tradition she came from. And I tried to sort of use that same method as I worked on my book.
It makes so much sense for this kind of a book, right?
Well, I mean,
well, the subject, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, what's happening to you is like very, very corporeal, right? It's very embodied. You know, when you're going through menopause, you're very much like you have trouble sleeping. The hot flashes are crazy. You feel like, who am I? You know, there's like so many different, you know, sexual things change. You know, there's a lot of changes that are embodied for sure. Yeah, for sure.
And I loved that her voice was throughout. And I also thought it was interesting that, okay, so I don't know how to actually, how would you say this in French? I think it's French. Georges Bataille?
Oh, Georges Bataille. Yeah.
Yes, Georges Bataille.
Yeah,
oh,
Bataille.
Of course, because
yeah,
I guess I've heard his name a lot. I just haven't read him until your book. And then seeing like, oh, right, because he's been throughout things too. Why was he so important, do you think, about the body for you?
Well, he's someone I read definitely in my early 20s. And, you know, when I first came to New York, my mid-20s, it was sort of like, it was my beginning of sort of avant-garde writing and being interested in Artaud and Kathy Acker and that whole world. And Bataille is sort of a forerunner to a lot of that. He talked very frankly about sexuality, very frankly about the body. So these were all things that I was very, very interested in. I mean, it's weird because it's like, I'm a minister's daughter. So you would think in a way, oh, there's a lot of shame. But in a weird way, there's a religious upbringing is very centered on the body. Like if, you know, because you have like, you know, you have like little Jesus on the cross, you know, you have a lot of suffering, which is like very embodied. And like, right, like you have a lot of like there's ideas of spirit and body. So
and
I had thought a lot about the body.
Yeah.
Healing. There's just a lot of the bodies in there quite a lot. And though people try to deny it and press it down. But so I was very I felt very much in sync with some of the writers that I was reading who seemed to be very interested in the body, and also the body in extreme situations, you know, whether it was sexuality, violence. I mean, those are the early writers that I was very much drawn to.
And that was in your 20s,
mm-hmm.
too. Yeah. Moving into the now, have you, and thinking about the novels, I think it's so interesting that you were also, when you were looking for books, you were looking not only for nonfiction books, but also novels of a woman, women of a certain age. And have you read Miranda July's yet? Cause I've got it. I just haven't started it yet.
Not yet. I don't know. I have to say of course I love her like everyone does, but I'm a little bit, when I've read the reviews, I've been slightly frustrated that that the sexuality is the thing that's the focus. Because I feel like, I mean, you read my book. I mean, my feeling is, I don't think wild sex is at the center of menopause, frankly.
No.
You know, and I just don't, I really think it's like kind of false to say it is. So, maybe she does a great job, and like I'm getting it all wrong. I will read it eventually. I don't usually read books like I don't like to read books when everybody else is. I usually wait a little bit, you know. but I don't know. I may be completely wrong because I have to read it and see. But that's something that's kind of turned me off a little bit. So
why?
I just feel like the only reason that women are interesting is their sexuality. I mean, the whole point of menopause and getting older is that we can get out from under that. I mean, right? Like
yes.
You can get out like from under being like purely sexual creatures. I mean, I'm sure her book is about her or the character's own sexual empowerment, which I'm totally for. It's just that it just seems like the same old thing. So I'm just a little bit like, I don't know. It's just hard like to get people interested in women's writing. It seems like there always has to be a sexual element. So.
I mean, your book clearly, like Flash Count Diary, Menopause, and the Vindication of Natural Life, Darcy, it clearly is like an exploratory. What I love about it is it's like you feel like you are actually trying to figure it out with your body and your mind too, obviously,
because right,
exactly. Lots of research and you're traveling places and you're
exactly.
You become like you're an activist, you know, at Sea mm-hmm. Aquarium by, you know, that like it's
yeah.
And kayaking, you know, on these long trips and
kayaking, yeah. I went to see Lolita has passed, which is sad. She was held captive for 55 years at the Miami Sea Aquarium. She just died recently.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I went to see her. That was part of the beginning of the book, and I just did that like out of the blue. It was weird. I had just learned that orcas were one of the few creatures that also went through menopause.
Yes,
like menopause besides women. And so then I was reading, about Lolita. And her play and how people wanted to release her and all this stuff. So I just decided, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but, and this has not never happened to me before. I was just like, I'm just going to fly down there and see her and talk to people about her and just to see a post-reproductive. Yeah, you know, she was also actually, so I was seeing another female creature like in menopause. So just to be in her presence, which was a very powerful experience. Mostly because it was so sad to see her stuck in that, like, you know, concrete tank, you know. But that was the first thing I did before I wrote, before I even started the book or had the idea, is I just flew down there for a couple days and you know, watched her do her, I mean, they make her do these stupid tricks and all this crap, but, you know, but.
Yeah. And so it was before you even had really thought of the idea of this book, but you did it. You acted on this.
It was weird. I think I had read, I don't know, maybe this wasn't in the same, but I think I had either heard or read Gloria Steinem say this. Like she said, it was about activism. She said, if you ever feel the impulse to go and do something, you should do it. Like, don't make excuses and don't go. So I had just heard that recently. And then I had heard about like Lolita and her struggles and the protesters and the fact that she was this sort of captive I also identified with her, you know, like a captive 40, you know, 50. I think she was my same age exactly, like a captive 59-year-old creature who had menopause, you know, that was sort of like bracketed as a, you know, so I felt, even though I am not like an orca, I felt a certain like identification with her, you know, so.
Yeah, I do. I love this, Darcy. And it's, and I also love how the story is like your thread with Lolita too, is, there's so many, like angles of it throughout the book, and part of it even becomes, you know, the different activists, how they want different things for Lolita. Then I think the hurricane comes through and there's worry about her, like she was, like so many things. And then by the end, I think you've got like a little girl, one of the other protesters. You have your sign and she has hers.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
She's also writing about Lolita because you tell her you are.
Yeah, she was so great. And it was so amazing when I'm like, you know, I'm writing a book. And she's like, oh, I'm writing a book too. It's so great. And she was fierce. Like she and her mom, I think they'd flown from Ohio or something. And the mother was saying, oh my God, she's obsessed beyond belief. You can't believe it. But thank God we have people like that, right?
Yeah, and
like a younger generation that's so cool and cares so much. I love that.
Thank goodness. And also you connect, also to take it back to Flash Count Diary for another moment here, is like you connect with perimenopause, menopause, postmenopause being this time where you're coming back to what was like the self in a way that could be this youthful self before, you know, the reproductive part of life is sort of becomes the determiner.
In some ways, some of that clears away and you have more time to worry more about the world's problems, you know?
Yeah.
And the other, and other creatures that are suffering and like other issues and whatnot, you know?
Then the spirit and let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Okay, Darcy, we'll be right back. Okay, today on Living Writers, Darcy Steinke is here. Well, via phone, her book, Flash Count Diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass and we'll be back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Darcy Steinke is here via phone. Flash Count Diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life, the book on the table with us. Darcy, so could we talk about the book with the great red dot on the cover? Was that your choice?
When you have a book, some place like FSG, they'll give you a couple choices. And I think it was Na Sun, this amazing designer, book designer who I've always loved. And I knew it was their favorite in the design department. You know, they showed you four and they were like, yeah, but this is the one, you know. And then she told me this great thing where she said that, that because there was no, maybe there is now, but there was no like icon for like menstruation, you know, on your phone.
Oh.
People used to use the Japanese flag, which is like a red dot.
Yes.
So like, you know, like women used to use on the Japanese flag. So that just like sold me on it completely. I was like, so, you know, it's kind of using something that, women didn't use themselves, you know, this thing. So I love that.
I do too. And it's so, it's so also interesting that it, it blocks out the S and E, like it's kind of dropped in there to,
it makes its own pause.
It does.
Yeah. Like it forces a pause.
And so Flash Count Diary, so this comes from the name of your composition notebook that you started writing in.
Yeah. So I was, I started, I mean, that's how the project started is I, maybe even before I went to see Lolita, I didn't know, you know, I never know what I'm going to do, but I just started to, I had these incredible hot flashes, you know, they were so overwhelming and so different than I had ever read about or ever seen portrayed. So I decided, and they were so kind of interesting in the way they sort of swept through you. And I decided I would keep a diary of them, like the actual physical experience of having them. And too, they were each different. You know, sometimes your stomach would somehow get hot. And sometimes it seemed like, you know, there was heat in your head that was coming out of your head. You know, sometimes like you just got like tremendously sweaty all of a sudden. So there were so many different ways that like it happened. So I started just to keep track of that in a diary. And then that's how the book kind of started through that, like in a very organic way. I was sort of like, well, you know, there's a lot of, I have filled a whole notebook. Obviously I'm very interested in this. Let's try to write a book that's, you know, very different than other ways that people have written about this, like more from the female body. You know what I mean? Not like trying to control the female body. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So.
And so with it, because I think when we start in the book too, I think it says like there's 9 so far, and I think you're on the subway. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Or there's night. Sorry, it's been a couple of days since I was in chapter one.
No, it's okay.
So I was like, I'm paging back to it now.
I definitely had some days where I had a lot, you know, so.
And then
I would flash throughout the day.
But you stayed with it. And did you start? Because that's also what I admire your tenacity with that. Because sometimes if I'm starting to document things, I'll do it. But I seem to have like a limited attention span. And then I'll be like, oh, I can document it in my memory. And then, of course, that is
a
complete joke. But did you start writing?
I'm very obsessed with my notebooks. You know, I have always many notebooks going for different, like I have a notebook called One Thing from Nature Every Day.
Yes.
So like when I walk in the park or even seeing a rat could go in there, you know what I mean? Like anything can go in there that's not human. And then I have don't do it as much anymore because she's grown up, but I had one where I used to like write things about my daughter. So I have like maybe 3 or 4 notebooks going at once. So I have my regular notebook and I have my notebook where I like talk about my anxieties, you know, and then I have like a notebook where I talk about my ideas.
Yes.
And then I have a notebook where I do my reading notes, you know, not like every book, but most books I have underlined enough things where I want to take a couple pages of notes on it. So I'm just very, very natural journal keeper, like for me, you know, so.
Yes. But I love that you also, you knew something was like interesting and different about these changing flashes as well. So they were like these different, they presented themselves in these discrete ways with different personalities.
Well, they had also been represented as something like funny on television, which I was angry about, you know?
Yes.
I was like, let's make fun of the lady that gets hot and is fanning herself. And, you know, I was really angry about that. Like I wanted them to be, I mean, nobody would make fun of someone that was having a seizure. I mean, it's just boilerplate misogyny, basically. So I was really angry about that too. So that, you know, that also drove me, you know, to be like, okay, this is what it's really like. It's tough. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, and I think that's like, I think Gloria Steinem would be like, pay attention to that too. Like this anger. And I love how in your book you say a lot of people are saying that the women are like becoming some monster, like this monstrousness about it with
yeah.
some of the,
mm-hmm.
the shifts in like temperament or so. But the, your book is actually making the case and showing how a lot of it is taking away the veils and like this, these, like the, how you have to store, like, or you've tamped down this anger or this.
Yeah, I think that's true. You're able to like, I was definitely able to access my anger. And that's something that also made me angry, where people were like, oh, you know, menopausal bitchiness, you know, menopausal grumpiness. Like, you know, like if you look up menopausal jokes, there's like tons of comedians talking about how terrible their wives are, you know, how grumpy their wives have gotten, you know. So I wanted to really push back against that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like it made me angry. Because it's not about that. It's really about getting in touch with what you really, I mean, it's kind of like I tell my daughter, the, you know, few days between you before your period, like, don't let anyone tell you that you're acting bitchy. Like, that's really what's happening is the hormonal veil that made you complacent and made you more like, okay, you can choose the restaurant, you know, like, that's fine, whatever, you know, like, that has been lifted away. And so you can actually see your life clearly. And sometimes you're pissed off about that. You know, right? So it's important to pay attention to what's happening in those days, because it's a point of lucidity, and that's what, and really menopause is just a long period of lucidity, you know. So, like the hormones have lifted, and then you can see your life a little more like clearly, and I think that's why a lot of women get kind of mad, you know. So,
and it's, yeah, so. And it seems like in some of the culture, that's uh-huh. unacceptable. And I think there's a great line of yours in here towards the end. Let me just see. Let's see, page 215. For everyone following along at home, they demonstrate to me what no human woman could, that it is not menopause itself that is the problem, but menopause as it's experienced under patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that's the problem. Yeah, I mean, there's just the problem. Also, it's debasement has a lot to do with, you know, women are mostly considered valuable for their sexuality and their fertility, and so once we've passed out of that, I mean, we haven't. I mean, I'm not saying we've passed out of sexuality, because that still goes on, mm-hmm. but fertility, we're less valuable, I think, to the patriarchy, and so I think they tend to just. They tend to debase us, you know, so.
And that's like the, like, and then that's can be some of the invisibility, or it can be when.
Yeah.
When folks
I think it
become,
can be like ignoring. Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are many levels. I think there can be ignoring.
Or fearful of.
Like fearful of. I think there can be. Yeah, I think there can be. And also just, it's a time of, you're getting older and wiser and more powerful. And it's a time of denying all that. Like, and instead just focusing on this, you know, negative thing, you know? So that's frustrating.
It is. It really is. Thanks for putting it into words, Darcy. And exploring it, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right now I'm doing actually like a zine experiment project where I'm also interviewing and asking people who want to share any of their stories about their own experience with perimenopause or questions.
Ooh,
or
cool.
And menopause and postmenopause. And the title of it is called The Flummox. And and so
cool.
When I read your part in Demigirl and Kemmering and that chapter where you say, I want to read stories not of propped up femininity, but of people who are disoriented but also electrified by their new hormonal configuration.
Yeah, exactly.
I loved that.
Yeah.
And I thought,
yeah,
oh, this is what I'm hoping for too.
Yeah. And you know, Kemmering is, I don't know if you've read, is it the Left Hand of Darkness? The Left Hand Side of Darkness by by like Ursula Le Guin.
I haven't, but I meant to read Le Guin.
It's about the planet where, I think it's her best one personally, but
okay.
It's about a planet where the people are both men and women, and they basically go into, actually when they're in Kemmering, they'll go into their more, I mean, they mostly like present as men, but then they like go into their female side, and that's when they mate and like all this kind of stuff. So the idea of sort of like being somewhere in the middle and not being so strictly female, that really appealed to me. So
yes,
the idea of Kemmering. Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting because so much of society is like, we're surrounded by all this conditioning of what needs to be. But so much of it is just like for preservation of, I don't know, in some ways,
yeah.
The species,
well, I mean,
or
really
whatever.
Been, I mean, gender's
people's
really
power.
Been blown open. I mean, right? Like, I mean,
thank goodness.
Really, yeah, totally. And like we can really learn a lot from the trans community. They've been very heroic. And that's something I write about in the book too, that I felt very inspired by the trans memoirs that I like read. And I sort of identified with some of them, particularly female to male trans memoirs, where, you know, they were going through a hormonal like transformation, which they weren't sad about. You know, like, it wasn't,
yes,
like, oh no, now I don't have any hormone, you know, female hormones. They actually were, you know, looking forward,
like, looking to
the
that
new
day.
Them.
Yes.
Yeah. So that to me was very inspiring, you know, very hopeful.
Oh, well, and that can be a shift for women going, right, for everyone, as a way to not see it as
totally.
Something to be fearful of or to.
Yeah, exactly. Just to be like, what is this new hormonal landscape going to be like?
I think also it's like, Darcy, when we're talking about this too, it's interesting to consider what folks would also be going through. Like if you've made the transition, but then your body is also still, as you age, certain things are coming back, and then you're also going through other stages of, like, I just think it can be so complicated in so many ways for everyone as we age. No matter really how we identify or what our biology is, and mm-hmm. It would be great if the US, for example, could get right more with like aging. Just for everyone.
True. Yeah, there's a lot of negativity around aging. It's hard. And I don't know what to say about that.
No, that's
kind of.
Okay.
I mean, it's just kind of like you get frustrated by it, but you're just like, I don't know what to say about it. There are people that work toward better lives for. I mean, I have like a very lovely life. I'm very lucky. I struggle, but I'm very lucky. But so I know there are, you know, people are aging that there's becomes particularly for women sometimes economic issues, and you know it's hard. You know. Yeah, so, but to age in a culture that's so obsessed with beauty and female sexuality and to like a hyper extent, you know, it's just not great, you know.
Yeah, and it seems like sexuality is in some ways, I don't know, I'm trying to think how to say this in a way that, I think it's kind of interesting how you capture it in Flash Count Diary when you talk about your like two very different times visiting Amsterdam and mm-hmm. The red light district.
Oh, right. And then the conference.
And the conference.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's take a short break and then let's pick up
okay.
with some of your research and including your trip for the conference, shall we?
Okay, okay. Sure.
Okay.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Today on Living Writers, Darcy Steinke is here via phone. Her book, Flash Count Diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Thank you. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers, and today Darcy Steinke is here. Her book, Flash Count Diary, Menopause, and the Vindication of Natural Life, out with Picador. Darcy, thanks for picking that beautiful song, too.
Yeah, by Max Richter. Yeah, that's the theme from My Brilliant Friend, you know, the Ferrante.
Yes, yeah.
I love those novels. The Neapolitan.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so good. And the TV show, too, is so good. Yeah.
Oh, that was on
I loved it.
Max, right? Or HBO
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, I loved it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm crazy for those books. They're so good. Yeah.
That writer is amazing.
Amazing.
And we won't forget about the conference. I'm going to write that down now. But what was your experience like when you read like book one, for example?
Well, I just was so excited. I'm friendly with the people at Europa, so I got an early edition, which is great.
Oh, nice.
And I read it, and I was like, oh, my God, it's so good. It was like so honest about the female body, so feminist, so raw. Like, it was just, I couldn't believe it.
And
also just such a rich reading experience, you know, like it really gets a hold of you.
It does. Could you go to sleep?
But not in like a cheap way, you know, not like a heavily plotted book with a murder in it or something. You know what I mean? It's just like, just such, so raw, so real. I just loved it.
It was so, also it was like so unsettling. Like I just had to keep reading. Like I couldn't go to sleep. So it kind of.
And then I worked hard to get the, whenever I knew one was coming, you know, I would get the galleys. And I think I reviewed the last one for the LA Times.
Oh, nice.
But that was mostly just a ploy to get the galley. You know what I mean? Like, so I could get it early, you know? So.
Exactly. I got to get my hands on this. So this is like the one time when you're like, I am reading this. Well, actually, you were sort of reading it before people were reading it, before it swept
so
everywhere.
Good.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah.
I love it.
I've sent a few copies to friends for sure. So as part of your research, you said like in the acknowledgments section, Darcy, that you interviewed over a hundred of varied, diverse women to hear their stories. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about like some of your other research too, like these trips.
Mm-hmm.
What was this? Because you went to this conference.
I went to a conference. I mean, I'll go back to the women because
Okay.
I mean, again, when you are going from the phenomenology kind of second sex, you know, kind of Simone de Beauvoir like model, like she also like interviewed lots of women.
Yes.
So I wanted to do that, and I did, you know, my friends, but I also put out things in Facebook. I live in a very culturally like diverse neighborhood in Brooklyn. I put up signs, so like I was able to get a wide variety of people, and that was a very important part of the book to me, to hear these other women's stories and to sort of like just kind of listen to what their experiences were. And they were also very, very, very anxious to talk. Like a lot of people, like a lot of women wanted to talk about it. Like I felt like there wasn't like maybe as much of a place in their lives to talk about it as maybe there could have or should have been.
But then there's
an international menopause convention or whatever. So I went to Amsterdam, and I don't know. I mean, I don't really know that much about science, and I don't know. I felt like I was a little bit disturbed by how conservative a lot of the doctor seems. And there was a lot of jokes about like how, you know, like I can remember one of the very first sessions I went to, they were talking, the four male doctors on the panel, the four male gynecologists were talking about how great hormones were, how much they helped their patients. And one in the Q&A, another doctor got up and said, oh, I love, I love hormones. My patients love them, you know. And I prescribe them all the time. And one of the doctors on the panel said, oh, that's why you look so young. It was all, it was, you know, implying again that like that's the point of hormones, is to make you look young and to keep you, you know, keep you appearing that you're in this fertile stage. And so that really turned me off.
It was a
European, you know. I think if I had gone to an American one, there would have been, because I think there are more female guys. I mean, But, you know, a lot of the women I talked to who were in their my age or older, you know, they were like, to have these male gynecologists in the 50s and 60s was rough, you know? I mean, I'm sure there are some wonderful doctors as well, but, you know, it was not always easy. I think because it was the European commerce, you know, this lot of male doctors, I don't know. I mean, there was a few women, but not as many as you would hope, you know, like...
It seems like an oversight for the planning committee if it's an international menopause.
But, you know, there's probably like people that are involved in the group. They get asked to be in the panels. I mean, I'm sure maybe there are like other female gynecologists in Europe that didn't come to the conference. But it was also what disturbed me was the. I'd never been to a medical conference, but the lobby is filled with all this, like, you know, vaginal rejuvenation wands and, you know, all this stuff to sort of like basically, I mean, kind of stuff youth oriented products for that, you know, like that the companies want to sell to the doctors, and then the doctors, they're hoping the doctors will like push some other patients. And that kind of turned me off too.
Right,
I just don't think it's a very good strategy. I just don't think staying the same. It's a very good strategy. Like, I feel like to go with the transition, I mean, I think is a better strategy, you know, personally.
Mm-hmm.
Though I don't judge, I'm not judging at all about the medical choices women make. I feel like women are judged enough.
Yes.
If hormones are working for you, great. I have no problem with that. It's more the way that the medical world has historically treated hormones as a way to kind of, I mean, they were, like, first of all, they were very, you know, very unsafe at the beginning because they didn't have the amounts like figured out. And so breast cancer sort of came out of that, and sort of uterine cancer, a lot of it.
Yes.
They've sort of solved that problem now, which is great. They've gotten the levels right, and it's not the problem that it once was. But it's not really about the woman's individual choice. It's more like the cultural idea that the way to like solve menopause is to stop it. I just don't think it's a very good strategy. You know what I mean? Like,
right. It seems like, and you do such a great like way of saying, like, showing the commercialization of it in a very like particular angle of it. And it seemed like your intent was like, I'm going to go and learn what the breaking news, like what's new in research and like what people might be presenting, like thinking of it as a think tank for the, you know, looking forward instead of what products could you sell that from this very narrow perspective, like you were saying.
I mean, and also I think shaming women about their aging bodies is just not, I'm really against that. I think it's horrible.
It's so good to be aware of it, isn't it? Because I think for so long, maybe people weren't, or I don't know. That sounds ridiculous to say, because I'm sure we feel it. But I think sometimes you can feel things, but you don't name it, or you don't take a moment to stand next to it and understand it. Like, what, you know, so hopefully if more people are talking about it and resisting it.
Yeah, I just think it should be like, just like a part of life. You know, there's puberty, there's birth, there's menopause, you know, just a normal female life cycle. You know what I mean?
Like, if you're lucky.
Exactly. And there needs to be more information about it.
Mm-hmm.
And also just acceptance of it. Like, you know what I mean? Nothing to be embarrassed about, you know, just a normal part of female life. I mean, that would be my hope.
Yes.
You know, so.
Oh, same here, Darcy. Same here. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Okay. We'll hear another one of Darcy's song picks today on Living Writers. Darcy Steinke joins us via phone from Brooklyn. Darcy, are you talking from Brooklyn?
Yeah,
today?
Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yeah, Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn, New York. Flash Count Diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life. We'll be right back. Thank you.
interventionist God. But I know, darling, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him. Not to intervene when it came to you. Well, not to touch a hair in your head, leave you as you are, if he felt he had to direct you.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today, Darcy Steinke on Living Writers, her book, Flesh Count Diary, Menopause and the Vindication of Natural Life. I'm T. Hetzel. Darcy, that was Nick Cave.
Yeah, Nick Cave. I love Nick Cave.
And tell me about this love.
Well, I've always loved him. I was drawn to him. You know, he sort of, I think in the early days when I would see his shows in New York City, he was still doing that. He kind of still does it, but not to the same extent. It's sort of like mad preacher kind of routine. Like he was like the preacher fronting the choir, like going crazy kind of like. And I very much, you know, I've come from a family of ministers and I very much identify with that. And also just the religious iconography in the songs mixed up with the humanity, like the combination of like the, I mean, I wrote a, essay about him a few years ago, and when I listened to all the songs, and they, what I really ended up loving about them, I think I probably always loved this, but now I realize why, is that the sort of the divine and the heavenly is evoked, but the songs always choose the human.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like it's not like it's a religious song, really. It's a song that both, like, admits the need for the spiritual sphere, but also stays on the human and stays on the body, you know?
Yeah.
So that's something that I really love.
Yes. Okay. Where can folks read that online, Darcy?
You can buy it. You can buy Nick Cave's book.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Stranger Than Kindness. It's a book that came out a few years ago. It's he had a show of all his sort of artifacts, like his journals, his song lyrics, his, you know, some of his crazy collections, and it traveled around. And so my book was, my essay was the front essay in the book, but he also has some writing in the book, which is quite good. And then if you want to look at, there's an abridged version online. I think it's the Pioneer Works website.
Yes. Okay.
I think that's where that is. Yeah.
Yeah. That, okay. Cause yeah, I loved how on that site too, it's so, such a great design of how I didn't realize it was the abridged version of it, but it's laid out with the images and then also the artifacts.
Yeah, it's great.
And what you're
writing. I really like it. And it was a very cool project. I was really lucky Nick Cave and I had many long phone calls, and it was a very rich, really rich experience for me to write about it. So it was great.
How did you connect with him originally do this?
Canongate did my put Flesh Count Diary out in the UK, and so Canongate is his editor there.
Oh, okay.
That's his publisher. So he was looking for someone to write the essay, and I guess he had read, I don't think he read Flesh Count Diary, but he read one of my novels, and so they contacted me and asked me.
Oh, that's
great. It's cool. I write, usually write about music or art in that form, maybe once a year, every other year. I'm asked to do some sort of an essay about art. I really enjoy that work a lot. You know, it's great.
And is that when you also did the piece on Agnes Martin?
Yeah, that a similar thing happened. Someone, I think someone in that case had read Flesh Count Diary, and they wanted someone to write, because she was older. She was actually older when she sort of became her most powerful, in her 60 and up, in a way.
Wow.
So,
oh, great. Inspirational.
They asked me if I wanted to write about her. So that also was an amazing experience where I went, it was my first trip. Like, it really wasn't even after COVID, but it was my first trip. Like, after I had been vaccinated, I flew to Santa Fe, where she she had her studio in her house in Taos, and I sort of drove around to all her spots and communed with her and went to the really wonderful, in Taos, there's the museum. They have a room of, I think it's 8 of her paintings in a room a room of its own. And they opened it up for me, which was really a rich experience, since it was closed because of COVID. So, that also was fantastic.
Yes.
So.
Oh, I'm so glad you do this about once a year, Darcy. Mm. I mean, it's
really fun for me. I really enjoy it a lot.
And
they just come to me too. It's kind of nice. I don't know.
That's so. I can't. Do you have one in the works now?
You know, I just did one for, I did one. Oh my gosh, I did one for TWB Books. Actually, let me just go look. I can go, because I'm going to forget the name of the. Linda Trawler. Like, I did a book. It's like an older photographer. I think she's like 85.
Oh wow!
And she had a practice of. A self-portrait practice ever since she was 16. So
awesome.
a book came out of all her her self-portraits, and so I wrote the essay for that. And that book just came out. That was also a very fun thing to work on, and very interesting. And you could talk up sort of about the aging female body, and I don't know, just women through the life cycle and all that. So that was really great.
Darcy, I'm going to get that. That is exciting.
Good.
That okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have much time left together. This has flown by, and I've loved it. I wanted to get to Granny. Okay. Since now.
Okay. Yeah. Granny. Yeah.
Like, here we are. We're getting older and older, and now we're to Granny.
Yeah. Okay.
So can you? Would you mind talking about your relationship with Granny? Because
Okay.
The moments are beautiful in your book.
Yeah. So the whales, excuse me, the whales that they found out about orcas going through menopause, and also that after their menopause around 45 or 50, they get so powerful and they have so much knowledge that they start to lead their group. There's a group of whales that live in the Salish Sea and outside of Seattle, and it's these three pods that they studied to find that out. So I also read a lot about these whales. I got fascinated, and the oldest matriarch in the group was a 105-year-old whale named Granny. And I went out to see the whales. You know, like, you can go whale watching. I went out, not on any motorized boats because that's bad for whales, but on sea kayaks. And I didn't really know like what I would see. Sometimes like you can go for a week and not see any whales, and sometimes you get to see whales. And I had memorized, though, I mean, the way they identify the whales is their dorsal fins will be shaped in a different way, or they might be discolored, or they have a notch. And Granny has a notch on hers because she probably had a run-in with a propeller at some point in her life. So I was out on the sea kayak. And I was with a group, which is a day group out, like in the Salish Sea, big long kayak, stroking the waves, very dramatic. And then hadn't seen any whales in the morning. Went back for lunch, and I kind of thought, okay, we're probably not going to see any whales. And so I hadn't seen any whales yet. I think I'd been there for like a few days, and then we went back out, and I was with the guide. He was in the back of my sea kayak. I was in the front. And he said, oh, I see the whales coming. They're coming down the strait, next to the island, San Juan Islands. And we waited, and they got closer and closer. And they were so much bigger than I expected. I really felt like I felt the water get displaced. Mm. When they came, close, I felt like us rise up a little. And I thought to myself, do I want to see whales? Because they seem somewhat frightening. But as they came by, there was a group of three that came very close, like I'd say just a couple yards from the boat. The the guide in back said, it's Granny. I see the knots. And I was like, no way. So I saw her big, you know, her big sort of grapefruit size eye. And she definitely was looking at us in a very censorious way. It wasn't like, it wasn't like a rich lady in her, you know, incredible encounter with her elephant. It wasn't that. It was like, it was very much like, you know, her kind of, you know, cause they're so smart. Their brains, are three times like the size of ours. They have spindle cells. I mean, you know, some people say they have the entire like ocean mapped in their, you know, head. So the look was very censorious. It was like, what are you doing? Cause see how much superior to her, like, we're just like sitting in these like kayaks, like watching her, you know, she just must be like, what are you doing? You know? So, but I was very connected. I would, even before I went, there's a sea link, a sea microphone under the water there. Mm-hmm. And I got it on my computer. So when I was working, I would listen and, you know, you would mostly, I actually learned like many things. Like I learned how shrimp sound, how like different like fish sound in the water, different like when the tide would go out. And sometimes I would hear whales calling to each other too. So I would listen to it like in my office in Brooklyn, you know. So I did that before I went, and I continued to do that after I went. But it was a very powerful thing to see her. You know, it's like a very, I mean, it's one of the most amazing experiences that I've ever had, you know. So to get to see her, and she died not that long afterwards. She died about maybe 8 months afterwards. I mean, they don't know, no one saw her get killed. It was just that they stopped seeing her, and the, you know, the, like her family no longer had her as a member anymore. So she must have died, you know?
You write it because you interview the person from the Whale Center on San Juan Island, the Whale Research Center. And uh-huh. I think they said she must have known that it was sort of, it was just her time, like her body. And so she didn't rise to breathe.
Well, because whales are conscious breathers, they have to, like, we breathe automatically, but whales have to consciously breathe. Mm-hmm. So she, I mean, it's true that she could have just, like, lost the ability to rise up, and because they're mammals, so they have to come to the top to breathe, and they can dive down. But yeah, the scientists felt like she just she feels like when elderly whales die that it's a conscious decision that they just decide it's kind of done for them, you know. So
that's a beautiful thing too,
and they choose not to come back up, you know. So
yeah, Darcy, thank you so much for talking today and for talking about your experience with Granny, because I know it's hard to put into words, you know.
No, it's amazing. I love talking about it.
Well, let's talk again sometime, because I've loved today. And thank you so much for writing Flash Count Diary, and for, you know, getting this conversation and talking to all, like, the many women's voices that you did, and putting your own story here and the research that you've brought to it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And yes, well, okay. Well, I'll say goodbye for now. Today on Living Writers, Darcy Steinke, Flash Count Diary, Menopause, and the Vindication of Natural Life. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time.
I'm here, barely see my breath surrounded. Jealousy and death, I can't be reached. Only heaven call, dragged underneath, separate from you all.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor Archives. Original air date November 15th, 2018 at 7 p.m.
Are you okay? I'd like to make a difference in the way your brain is functioning right now, and I'm going to do this with some old records. You want to listen to some old records? I think if we do this together, we might make a difference just in everything we do. If we find a way to relax and listen to what the ancestors have to say, all of these records for the first part of the program are from 1928. The program in question is Face the Music. My name is R. Wolf, R. Wolf. We're on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. I'm thinking momentarily of a passage in Dizzy Gillespie's autobiography, To Be or Not to Bop, which is largely he and his friends just talking. So it's a transcribed autobiography with lots of other people chiming in. And at one point, Diz said that when he was young, he said, when I was coming up, I didn't understand Louis Armstrong's manner, his attitude. He said, I thought, well, he's just tomming, you know, laughing and grinning and smiling in the face of white racism. But then he said he got a little older and he started to realize that this was some very powerful stuff that Louis was doing with his whole demeanor. And it all renders down to this stance, which is nothing